Your difference is our strength on Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge. Today, that new world is struggling to be born, a world quite different from the one we've known. End quote. Now, just what do you think he's talking about? A trip to Disneyland?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, Ukraine's coalition government's fallen apart yesterday, and as of last night, the country's got no prime minister. What are the implications of that for what's going on in Central Europe at the moment? Also, how did Hitler get to power? Well, worryingly, some of the conditions that helped him into office are a distinct possibility today. We look at the rise also of the far right in Europe. And protesters occupy land outside the BBC here in Bristol to protest about the corporation's coverage of the Israeli genocide going on in Gaza. Are the modern Western intelligence agencies totally out of control? We pay, but what they're up to, they won't say. The spooks are in bed with the arms industry and they're creating havoc across the world. Following on from last week's talk by former MI5 officer turned whistleblower Annie Machon, we ask, what does what we know about modern spooks mean for the way we look at 9/11 and other big terrorist attacks today? And what, if anything, can we do about it? We'll be hearing from a former US spook who believes everyone who even does a tiny bit can make a difference. We start by looking at one of the main stories this week. Well, actually, it wasn't a bit trumpeted, but it's a very important one with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. And that's the phone hacking story. Martin, we hear that there was a royal connection which has been blamed for the police failings in the original phone hacking investigation. This is James Hanning in The Independent last Sunday. A desire not to embarrass the royal family has emerged as a key reason why the Metropolitan Police failed thoroughly to investigate phone hacking at the News of the World back in 2006. It's widely assumed that the Met's decision to prosecute just two people, royal reporter Clive Goodman and private investigator Glenn Mulcair, was down to extensive links between the paper's owner, News International, and Scotland Yard. The pair were convicted in early 2007, found guilty of listening to the voicemails of royal household staff and five others. But a new book, The News Machine, written with Mulcair's cooperation, makes the claim that the decision by him and Goodman to plead guilty enabled the police to draw a line under the investigation because it gave them the conviction that they wanted without having to ask the royal princes to appear in court. Now, amazing that the royal family still have such an influence over a very important story, and the police simply weren't doing their job because they had prima facie evidence of many other criminal offences which simply weren't prosecuted.
Yeah, but you're presuming that the explanation we're being given here is the real explanation. It could well be that, I don't know what the explanation is, but it could well be that the Metropolitan Police didn't want to actually investigate further of the, because they themselves were implicated in many aspects of the hacking scandal. So if they can say, we couldn't go into this in any more detail because it would have embarrassed the royal family, it's a very handy sort of excuse.
Yeah, it's a very early attempt to put a lid on it. And fascinating, I think, this is another reason. Completely agree with you. It may have been other reasons too. But this is another one. The idea of the royal family appearing in court, it doesn't seem to sort of work. And I remember with the Paul Burrell case, for example, that the Queen was due to appear in court potentially to give evidence in that case, and the whole case was pulled at the last minute. So it does seem that the royal family, although, potentially, supposed to be everyone equal under the law, they are not really interested in going to court.
Well, no, but I mean, I think there's more to this than the royal family being embarrassed. I suspect, call a spade a shovel, News International were effectively running a private intelligence service. They were collecting all sorts of dirt on all sorts of people, and they were using that dirt in their magazines and newspapers. But they were also collecting dirt on all sorts of people which wasn't used, and that worries me even more, because they were using the dirt that they were collecting which wasn't used for private bargaining, for example, with politicians, about things like whether Murdoch should be allowed to take over B Sky B or whatever. And if somebody who is involved in making that decision knows that Murdoch is in fact holding a piece of information about them that they wouldn't want to be seen in the news of the world, then that really is the issue. And people are missing the point here. It isn't just gutter journalism. We're talking about a private source of power far greater than ought to be allowed. And of course, that private intelligence service is using the police as one of its sources of information. This is the point, isn't it?
The police have an amazing amount of discretion, don't they, it seems, that they can have prima facie evidence of a fantastic amount of very serious crime, and yet, because nobody knows about it, nothing happens.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, the News of the World were that the police were cooperating with this News International Intelligence Organisation, not least because police officers looked as if they were actually getting something out of it, and therefore they're collecting information by phone hacking and so on. They're also getting information from the police, and the police are protecting them from the consequences of what they're doing. Didn't anybody realise that it's illegal to bug people's phones? Because it is. I don't think there's any doubt about it. It is. It just is. And they all must have known that while they were doing it. But they all thought they could get away with it because the police had been squared off. That's the problem.
Well, we've also had this the story this week about the Met putting even Jean-Charles de Menezes' family under surveillance. Yep. It seems there's a tremendous amount that the police are up to, that if it was exposed to the light of day, I mean, it's in a way like talking to George just now about the Public Property Board being open. If it was exposed to the light of day, the police would be utterly condemned for. Well, I mean, Jean-Charles de Menezes' family were the victims, and yet the police are spying on them.
Yes, well, I mean, that's what's coming out about the special demonstration squad is particularly worrying, isn't it? They were linked to Special Branch. They've been working since 1968, and their goal basically has been to mess up the radical forces in the society, infiltrating environmental groups, protest campaigns, anti-racist groups, and of course infiltrating all of these campaigns for justice of people who've suffered either at the hands of the police or racists, all of which is very worrying. But of course, if that's what the Metropolitan Police have been up to, have a think what MI5 and MI6 are up to, who haven't got any scrutiny over what they do at all. And I think we start to begin to realise the scale of the secret state in this country. It's not in any way smaller than the sort of thing that used to go on in places like East Germany. It just doesn't look as obvious.
Okay, with Jean-Charles de Menezes, the guy who was shot dead on an underground train, completely innocent man, an electrician, there were allegations that the family was spied on by undercover officers. The special demonstration squad gathered information on the relatives of Jean-Charles de Menezes. He was mistakenly shot, apparently, by an anti-terror police, although there are allegations that they were actually soldiers acting with the anti-terror police in London in 2005. The family received £10,000 from the Met, and they may be now in line for a further payout because of this. But it is pretty horrific when you are the victim to then be treated almost like a suspect by the police.
Well, what's clearly wrong here is that the police are infiltrating campaigning against their activities. Obviously, it's in their interest to have the information about what these campaigners are doing, but is it in the public interest for the police to spend public money on infiltrating campaigns against their own behaviour? And the answer to that is probably no.
I mean, let's look at the phone hacking, for example, in comparison to this, because we've heard about a few cases that the Special Demonstration Squad and others were infiltrating. Isn't the likelihood that actually this is the tip of the iceberg? There could be many other campaigns,
absolutely,
environmental campaigns, social justice campaigns, that the police have actually been on the wrong side. They seem to have lost the sense, the Met anyway, of the difference between right and wrong.
Well, I would just argue that this has been going on for years, and presumably they shrugged their shoulders and said this has been going on for years. The point I would make about all of this is it's illegal. we've either got a rule of law or we haven't got a rule of law. And if the police are breaking the law, then that's then they should be obviously they ought to face the consequences. The people who set the special demonstration squad up, the people who ran it, the people they should be basically sleeping in their beds in fear of being arrested now because it's all come out.
Yes,
and this, of course, is why something like the Police Service of Northern Ireland had to be set up in Northern Ireland as part of the peace process, because the RUC had been engaged in similar activities for years and years and years, and that was no longer acceptable.
But I would put it
to
you that these police are actually the mayor, detectives, etc., maybe retired senior police officers, are actually sleeping quite comfortably in the knowledge that they're not going to be arrested for this.
Ah, well, that's the problem, isn't it? In that case, we haven't got a rule of law. So terrorist groups, let's call them the real IRA or whatever we want to call them, or any terrorist group will say there isn't a rule of law. There is no rule of law. There's no point going through the system. There's no point trying to get justice by peaceful means. Let's go around and blow their heads off, because that's effectively what the IRA used to do with the IUC. We don't trust you. We know you're playing dirty tricks. We can play dirty tricks too.
So do you think there's going to be some kind of change in the way the Met's run, that Scotland Yard's run, in a similar way to what happened in Northern Ireland?
Well, the same sort of pressure is not there. I think there is pressure
for change.
Well,
there is quite a lot of pressure for change, isn't there?
I think... As more becomes available to us, the pressure on the establishment to change the way they've operated over the last 30 or 40 years will gradually become overwhelming. And I would just stress again, those who have broken the law, for example, many of these actions clearly break the law, they should be punished. And it's essential for the police to be seen to be punishing those within their own ranks who have broken the law. And, this isn't... If you want to kind of build a society where people are willing to cooperate with the civilian police force because they're trusted, then they've got to earn that trust by clearing out their dirty washing.
Well, do you think that it's possible that the alleged child abuse ring associated with the Elm Guest House in London and Westminster, that will be properly dealt with by the police?
Well, one hopes that it will be. My suspicion is that these child abuse rings have been tolerated at the heart of the establishment because they've been used for blackmail by forces like the forces that I'm suggesting. You know, the secret services have basically used... MI5 were accused of using the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland as a honey trap for loyalist politicians who are, encouraged to go in there, have sex with underage boys, which are all being videoed. There's suggestions that the Dunblane killer, whose name now escapes me, had been procuring basically boys for senior politicians in Scotland as part of... blackmail attempts potentially by the Americans and by others. Now, in other words, all of these things are linked.
But there's the two inquiries set up by Theresa May. One has already hit the buffers because Lady Butler Schloss has resigned from it, so we don't have anybody actually running that inquiry anymore. The other one, which is being run by the head of, the chief executive of the NSPCC, a lot of questions being raised about him too. He's a former top civil servant who worked for top government ministers in the major years. I think it was Michael Portillo, etc. And there are many people also saying that he's not necessarily the type of person that the victims would trust. So they've got to surely find somebody to run one or either or both of these inquiries who the victims would trust.
Well, you'd have thought so, wouldn't you? I mean, in the real world, those who are guilty try to cover their tracks, whether they're individuals or structures. And these structures are embedded in the secret state. I mean, the existence of the special demonstration squad was only found out a couple of years ago, even though it's been operating with hundreds of people
and that was
only due, since 1968.
That was due to a very brave, I would say, police whistleblower who was actually not going to make any friends by doing so.
Indeed, if he hadn't spoken up, we would be none the wiser. Now, if that's just the Met, so the Met have got hundreds of undercover police officers in things like environmental groups. Don't forget, it's not just the British secret services that will be operating in Britain. I was talking to somebody the other day who was saying, well, during the South African apartheid era, the South African secret services boss had hundreds of people operating as undercover operatives in Britain. And if you can multiply that out, the Saudis will have their secret undercover operatives operating in the USA, in Britain. You know, so Britain, as an international country, has probably got more spooks per square centimetre than anywhere else on earth.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And we hear this week from Mark Leftley, one of my favourite journalists over at the business section of The Independent. Sellafield cleanup is getting messier as a failing consortium faces takeover. The costs are spiralling up to, guess what, how much is it going to cost to clean up Sellafield, decommission the place? £70 billion. Now, we were sold this whole thing of nuclear power, weren't we? It's free power, I think, at some point a long, long time ago. Unions are demanding answers over the future of Sellafield, one of the world's most hazardous nuclear sites, as the US engineer leading toxic cleanup work there faces a $4 billion takeover. Last week, California's AECOM, AECOM, that is, announced that it's agreed to buy the rival URS in a deal that could be worth £3.5 billion once the debt's included. But it's interesting, all the figures have started rolling out about how much this entire cleanup operation at Sellafield's going to cost. The figure is £70 billion. Martin, it just doesn't sound feasible that anybody would sign a contract to build a place knowing that it was going to cost so much to clear up, unless they're just thinking, well, a future generation can deal with that, we don't care.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, nuclear power developed as a byproduct of the nuclear weapons industry. So if you're going to build nuclear bombs, and we were, because we claimed that we needed them to deter the Russians, whatever the rationale was, you've then got all of this nuclear waste. So there was a push, not just in Britain, but all over the world, to turn this nuclear waste into something user-friendly, atoms for peace, etc.
Well,
the idea was that it'll be so cheap, because you're not taking account of the waste, that it would be too cheap to meter when it was originally suggested. But it clearly isn't too cheap
British
to meter, is it?
The government signed this contract with this company, URS, and now it's being another company's taken over. Everyone's crossing their fingers that the new people are actually going to honour all the deals that they've made with this previous company. It just all sounds like it's getting very, very messy.
Well, it is very messy. I mean, I've seen some statistics that suggest that the looking after Britain's existing nuclear waste stockpile costs every taxpayer 2p in the pound on income tax. So you could reduce income, standard rate of income tax by 2p if we didn't have all this nuclear waste to look after. And we go on about so much waste on welfare and, people cheating on their benefits or not, and what have you. And the nuclear power industry is sucking wealth out of this. Most people have no idea where the money goes. They go on about waste in Brussels or whatever, but 2p in the pound on income tax is spent on just dealing with it. It doesn't get rid of the waste, just dealing with it.
Just a reminder of that figure, £70 billion is going to cost to clear it up, the mess that's been made over the years there.
That's probably an underestimate.
The most vociferous people campaigning are actually the workers through the GMB union. The people that work at these nuclear plants are saying they're demanding a statement from the company on the intentions for Sellafield. We want to know, they say, what due diligence government has done on the takeover too. An industry source added the ownership change would just plunge Sellafield's leadership into yet more confusion at a critical time as the consortium tries to wrestle control of the decommissioning programme. Well, it sounds all a little bit like Snowden and GCHQ, Martin. You know, behind the barbed wire, actually, it's complete chaos. And in a way, the barbed wire is to keep the public out so that we don't know what's going on in there.
Well, that's right. I think the reality is that the nuclear waste we've already created in this country is going to be a burden on future generations. It's going to cost a lot more than £70 billion probably in the end. But I don't see that there's any case for the nuclear industry to be privatised or for the private sector to have any involvement in it, because it clearly doesn't make any money at all. And if they're making money at it, there's a problem. We're going to have to chuck public money down this drain for generations to come. Stupid decision to build them in the first place, but we're stuck with it now, aren't we?
The connection with Bristol, of course, is that we've got Hinkley Power Station just down the road near Bridgewater, and those trains, we're carrying that nuclear waste, come through Bristol Templemeads every week. I think it's on a Wednesday, it used to be anyway. We had all sorts of trouble filming it, I can remember, years ago, because they kept the train outside the station until we'd gone with the camera and then brought it through. They were spying on us, basically, the nuclear police, armed police. But anyway, the point really being that once those nuclear fuel rods come out of the reactors down at Hinkley, they go into a pond, To cool down. It takes them something like a year, 6 months to cool down. The new power station they're planning, it will take them even longer. Once they've got, been cooled down, they then get transported by train up to Sellafield and reprocessed. And much of the waste from Sellafield then gets, rather than treated as nuclear waste, it gets sold as depleted uranium shells.
Well, that's right. You could try and get recoup some of this money by turning it back into weapons, couldn't
you?
And
then fired another country, another part of the world, for example, Iraq, leading to massive birth defects. It such seems a poisonous industry. Is there going to be really any future for nuclear, and particularly Hinkley?
Well, I don't think there is any real economic future for nuclear, and that's probably what's going to be the death knell for it. If you actually look at the real costs of nuclear power, it's simply not viable, as Friends of the Earth have said on this programme quite frequently. The problem is, from an economic point of view, the existing waste cannot be wished away, and we are going to have to spend money managing that waste for centuries to come. So anybody who works in the nuclear industry shouldn't worry too much about their job, because frankly we're going to need nuclear engineers and people who can manage this waste for the indefinite future. But I don't think we should be building any more. And that's clearly what the, you know...
But the Chinese have said they'll pay for it, or they'll at least finance it.
Well, that's because what the Chinese have got a communist-run economy where they can do lost leaders like that, you know, they can do bog-offs and what have you, because they've, and the French are very keen to sell their nuclear industry, because they've spent so much money developing it, the only way they're going to get any of that money back is by selling on. So it's like a pyramid selling game for the Chinese and the French.
But the whole point of the nuclear industry when it started back in the 1950s, I guess it was, for nuclear weapons, which, by the way, Dr. Beeching was involved in, as we know. Richard Cotterill's book about Beeching has exposed that the guy that closed down our railways, we were talking about that with George too, was also the guy that was building the Britain's nuclear weapons, that it was designed to actually make plutonium. That's the way you make plutonium, from nuclear power stations and reprocessing the waste at Sellafield. But surely there's plenty of plutonium. Do we need any more plutonium?
Well, we shouldn't be making any more nuclear weapons, and we shouldn't be making any more nuclear power stations, but we'll still have to manage the consequences of our folly in the past, won't we?
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, the Ukrainian Prime Minister resigned yesterday evening as the coalition fell apart over in the country. This is from Kiev, and I was quite surprised to see the BBC weren't reporting this last night at all. Not even up till midnight anywhere, even on their website. Maybe they hadn't been told what to think by the Americans about it. But anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about this? This is pretty devastating, and then there's a very, obviously very important country, but the coalition's fallen apart now.
Well, obviously this news about this is still coming out, but I think what's actually happened is that the IMF structural adjustment programme, which was imposed on Kiev if they were going to get an IMF loan, and of course the IMF loan would never have been spent inside Ukraine, it would have just been used to pay off Ukraine's creditors, the politicians of the populist right and elsewhere just thought, well, we can't sell that to the people who vote for us, and the government has just decided to disband and ban the Communist Party from the Rada. That hasn't been reported either, even though they got 18% at the last fully free and fair election in Ukraine. Incidentally,
hang on, why has the Communist Party been banned? Surely, if you're going to have a democracy,
because there seems to be they're a disloyal party because they're supporting separatists in the east, according to their opponents in the Rada. But another interesting thing that I discovered today is that the BBC Russia actually went to where the plane had crashed down. This plane,
MH17,
had crashed,
yeah.
And they were interviewing locals, and the locals were saying, "Well, what we saw was what we think were Ukrainian jets shooting it down." And that's what all the locals were saying in this BBC film. And that was actually put up
In Russian or Ukrainian?
I think it was in Russian, because it's BBC Russia, so it's in Russian. But it's now been taken off the BBC website, but it has been retrieved by cyber guerrillas. And
okay, where can we find that? That sounds like an interesting one.
Well, if people log on to our programme, www.thisweek.org, later...
Thisweek.org.uk. Yeah.
Later.
Okay, we'll put the link up to this
BBC film. But, of course, what happens, of course, is that the news about conflicts like Gaza and Ukraine is very, very political. So what happens is that, you know, journalists on the ground may discover one thing, but by the time it comes out into it, you know, gets out, it's already been doctored. But of course, they obviously weren't keeping too much of a tight leash on their Russian journalists, and it managed to leak out, but it's now been killed. But of course, in the days of the internet, Tony, no story ever is killed. So as long as somebody's got a copy of it, then it's out there.
So two parties have pulled out of the coalition. The Prime Minister's resigned. Which parties have pulled out? What do you think? How do you think?
Svoboda. I think it's Svoboda, which is a very right wing. It's one of the. It's the fascist, but not Nazi party, unlike Pravi Sektor. It's because the IMF is trying to impose on Ukraine things which are unacceptable even to the West Ukrainians. And of course, this is the root cause of the crisis in the first place, is that in order to have some kind of promise of joining the EU, they're not actually going to be allowed to join the EU, it's just a promise to be considered at some future point, you've got to push through all of this super Thatcherite policy, which of course is always going to be a disaster for them. I mean, I predicted that this would happen in 1998 in the book I wrote with Laszlo Andor, who's now a European Commissioner, saying that if they try to force a Thatcherite policy on the Ukraine, the country will split apart, because the people in the east will, you know, they're like a great big north of England, North Yorkshire. They've got loads and loads of steel mills, coal mines, what have you. The last thing they need is a super duper free market policy. Let's close it all down. So up to now, the government in Kiev has avoided such a policy because they knew it was going to be provocative. And then, of course, they rammed it down their throats. And predictably enough, the East Ukrainians were not going to swallow it.
Now, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, is actually welcoming this breakup of the ruling coalition.
Well, possibly he's thinking that he can... don't forget that an agreement was made with Yanukovych before the coup, that the parliament would be the senior partner and the president would be the junior partner. So Poroshenko is quite happy for the parliament to break up because he thinks power will come back into his hands. But what you could now see a simultaneous rebellion against Kiev from the East Ukraine and from the West Ukraine, which is the power base of the fascist and Nazi parties, the Svoboda and Pravi Sektor. And, you know, when I call Svoboda the fascist party, that's to distinguish them from Pravi Sektor, who are out-and-out Nazis.
One of the consequences of this is likely to be early parliamentary elections over in Ukraine. Surely that's going to be a good thing, actually.
Well, when there's early parliamentary elections, they say October. But don't forget, you've got a crisis that's going on now this minute. I mean, what should have happened when Poroshenko was elected, he met with Putin at the Normandy.
But the Poroshenko is here is going to be a stabilising influence. Most of the, you know, he is there, whatever, you know,
Listen, but Poroshenko met with Putin at the Normandy commemoration. And, you know, he didn't particularly want to meet with Putin, but Putin made a point of buttonholing him. And Putin's position was, look, you've just won an election in the West Ukraine. You've obviously got some support, otherwise you wouldn't have won it. Let's get together and negotiate a deal for some kind of autonomy for the East Ukraine. We're not going to try and annex East Ukraine. I know they want to join Russia, but we're not going to let them join because it's going to cause problems. Let's do a deal. And that's what should have happened. That was the way to defuse the crisis. Putin was putting himself forward as, I will, you know, get my people to behave themselves and stop shooting. You get your people to stop shooting, and surely we can come to some arrangement here. They don't like being governed from Kiev, and they're not happy about it, and they haven't participated in the election. You've just been elected fairly convincingly, although in the East Ukraine he got hardly any votes. But nevertheless, there's a possibility there of a negotiation. And one interesting theory that I've heard about the MH17 problem is that Poroshenko is a relative moderate, and in order to get rid of Poroshenko, the Interior Ministry, which is run by Andriy Paryby from Pravi Sektor, were the ones that redirected the plane over the zone that it was redirected over to be shot down by whoever, by a plane or by the Buk missile, which is probably, don't forget the Buk missiles. Who's got Buk missiles? The Ukrainian army's got Buk missiles. There's no direct evidence that the rebels have got any such system. But what the people in the video were saying was that what the Russians have pointed out is that the plane was being shadowed by Ukrainian fighters, and that it's perfectly feasible for those Ukrainian fighters to have shot it down. Interestingly enough, David Cameron Cameron has already made up his mind what's happening, and he's already decided it was definitely the Russians and this, that, and the other's got to
happen.
Well,
it sounds like you have too.
Well, no, I haven't made up my mind. I'm just letting people know what the various theories that I've been looking at. But in actual fact, the Dutch investigators are taking a much more measured view, as they might. And when the Dutch guy first arrived, who was in charge of it, said, well, they've done a pretty good job of finding all the bodies and putting them in the refrigerated wagons. I mean, that's what we'd expect them to do. We're quite happy with it. So, in other words, there are moderate people on both sides who are trying to find a way to sort out what's happened with this tragedy. Well, and why can't, well, I mean, the tragedy ought to be a wake-up call for everybody, however it happened, to stop the fighting and negotiate. But it's being used by political forces in the West and by fascist forces within the Ukraine to build a hysteria for war and sanctions against Russia. And I think war with Russia is not really on their minds. The sanctions against Russia are so important because that then forces the West Europeans to stop developing relations with Russia, particularly the Germans, and get back to mummy being the United States of America.
So why are we in a situation where the Germans, obviously with their history of fascism from many years ago, are actually, it seems, approving of these far-right groups, the Pravi Sektor and Sloboda Party, in these key positions?
Well, the German protege in all of this was this guy Klitschko, who's a former boxer, and he was pushed aside. So if you remember when Victoria Nuland was on the phone, the US attaché out there, they were saying, well, is Klitschko going to be taking over? He said, no, F the EU, we're going to have Yatsenyuk. So in other words, Klitschko was the German protege, he was pushed aside, and Yatsenyuk was pushed in. And therefore, there's a tension which people are not picking up between the German position here and the US position. Don't forget, German industrialists are very heavily invested in Russia. They do a lot of work, they do a lot of
Don't seem to be picking up is this connection I'm making between a formerly fascist country, Germany, and actually pushing a new regime in Kiev, which has key positions taken by fascists. Well, I'm talking about security, policing, this
yes.
kind of thing.
Well, people in Germany, like the Die Linke Partei, the left party, have said, you know, this is fascism, you know. But you've got to understand that public opinion in Germany is probably the most pacific in Europe. They do not want to fight in the Ukraine. They're very aware that these far-right parties are fascist parties. And ordinary public opinion in Germany does not want a war with Russia. And for good reason. I mean, Germany has learned its history. There was an interesting article yesterday about how they are remembering World War I. And, of course, they're remembering it in a much less bombastic way than we are. They're remembering it as a tragedy for Europe, in which Germany played a major role. And Germans are very aware that the World War I and World War II was fermented within Germany, and ordinary people are very aware of that, and actually rather, you know, much less inclined to go kicking other people's sandcastles over than people in the United States of America who've never had a war in their lives, really.
Finally, on Ukraine, we've had two rather large scuffles with fist fights going on in the Ukrainian parliament, connected with this whole business of the Communist Party being excluded. It doesn't look good, does it? It may be an early general election is exactly what they need in Ukraine.
Yeah, but if they have an early general election, the people in Crimea and the people in Donetsk and Luhansk will not participate in it. So it'll be a general election for the rump Ukraine.
And in the meantime,
and with the Communist Party banned.
And in the meantime, President Poroshenko, a lot more power is going to be in his hands. How do you think he's going to handle it?
Well, I think what Putin is looking for from Poroshenko is that you and me can do a deal here. Why don't we? Poroshenko's background, by the way, his father was a gangster. Tymoshenko, who's the Svoboda Party, she was in prison. And her one of her main business associates is Semyon Mogilevich, who's the head of the Russian mafia. So we're being presented a very, very one-sided picture of what's going on in Ukraine in the Western media. But in the real world, frankly, deals can be done by those who've got a sufficiently broad perspective on the situation.
I said finally, but we also mentioned specifically this downing of this Malaysian airliner. There's a lot of people wondering if there's any connection between the previous Malaysian airliner that disappeared and this one. It's quite clear, isn't it, that not only are the Malaysian government, this former British colony, actually, quite independent-minded when it comes to people like the IMF, the big guys in finance, finance. But they've also, over several years now, retired judges, former premier as well, have put Bush and Blair on trial for war crimes and found them guilty. They've made a big, big point of this in
Malaysia. Yes, and they've also questioned the official story on 9/11. Mahathir Mohamad, who was the former president, was very clear about that. Now, listen, let's look at it this way. If you are going to play a false flag game in Ukraine, and I'm not saying this is what's going on, it's more than likely an accident, whoever shot it down. But if it wasn't an accident, it won't have been shot down by the rebels or by the Russians. It'll have been shot down by elements, I'll put it much stronger than that, within the current Ukrainian government. Some of the people who don't want compromise.
So what possible motive? Well,
if you're going to shoot down an airliner, shoot down a Malaysian airliner, because the Malaysians are whipping boys for the Americans anyway. So if you're going to shoot down a random civilian airliner, choose a Malaysian one, because we don't like them anyway.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Meanwhile, over in the Middle East, some documents released by Edward Snowden, a testimony anyway by Edward Snowden, says that the ISIS leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, was trained by the Israeli Mossad. This is the Gulf Daily News, and Global Research carried this article too. The former employee at US National Security Agency, Edward Snowden, has revealed that the British and American intelligence and the Mossad worked together to create the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS. Snowden said the intelligence services of three countries created a terrorist organisation that's able to attract all extremists of the world to one place using a strategy called the Hornet's Nest strategy. NSA documents refer to recent implementation of the Hornet's Nest to protect the Zionist entity, they call it, that's obviously Israel, by creating religious and Islamic slogans. According to documents released by Snowden, the only solution for the protection of the Jewish state is to create an enemy near its borders, Martin.
Yes, well, I think that's that sounds about right, and it's interesting that Snowden is now pointing out that this is actually what's going on. And it's also interesting, of course, that the three teenagers that were supposedly killed, well, they were killed which kicked off the fighting recently in Gaza and elsewhere, ISIS claimed to have killed those teenagers. So, but the government in Tel Aviv decided to blame Hamas. Now, can you see how ISIS fulfills the goals of the Israelis and the Western powers? Don't forget who set up Al-Qaeda. It was set up in Jordan by the Western powers, with MI6 as the lead agency, and London was its other secondary headquarters. Hence, the French police's concern about Britain becoming London becoming Londonistan. People have got to understand that these very extreme Sunni groups have a long-standing relationship with Western intelligence services. Go figure.
Leaks revealed that ISIS leader and cleric, this is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he actually took intensive military training for a whole year in the hands of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence services, besides also courses in theology and the art of speech. So that, in other words, you know, sort of coaching for media work and rallying the troops, this kind of thing.
I think what's beginning to happen is even the stupidest people around the world are beginning to realise that this Islamic extremist threat, which we've been told to be absolutely terrified of since 9/11, is essentially, and its fundamentals, an intelligence service front for the West. So you've got genuine liberation organisations like Hezbollah and Hamas, mass-based organisations who do all loads of social work as well as their fighting and all the rest of it. They are completely undermined by more and more crazy extreme groups to their so-called left.
But I don't
left.
Understand why Snowden's saying here, the only solution for the protection of the Jewish state is to create an enemy near its borders. Surely that's the last thing that Israel wants.
No, the point is that Hamas and Hezbollah are enemies of ISIS. So my enemy's enemy is my friend. So ISIS are completely undermining Assad and Hezbollah. And they're also undermining, if they could get away with it, they'd try and undermine Hamas in Gaza. Before Hamas took over in Gaza, the Palestinian intelligence services arrested a suicide bombing cell, and when they interrogated them, they admitted that they were working for Mossad. They'd tried to set up an Al-Qaeda cell in Gaza, but it was run by Mossad, and they gave a press conference where these guys were wheeled out and said, "Yes, we are Al Qaeda, but we're actually Mossad," and everybody ignored it. And of course, people have got to realise that there is not just one flavour of Islamic extremism. There's a whole there's a whole smorgasbord of different kinds of Islamic extremists, and the Western intelligence services and the Mossad have been playing on them like a pipe organ for 30 or 40 years.
It just sounds very much like the original Crusades. Very, you know, similar.
Well, no, but they what the intelligence services of the West, the MI6s, CIAs, and Mossad want to do is to create simplify everything down so it is the Crusades in the minds of the population. These bad people who hate us for our liberties and they hate us for our freedoms and undermine.
What I'm saying is there was a lot of manipulation of religious fervour in the Crusades.
Well, I mean, when you go back to the Crusades, you've got a situation where the kind of information overload we have now didn't exist.
No, that's
so
right,
it was quite easy
was
to make people
very,
think
very far away, wasn't it?
Yes, well, they had dogs, they have. You know, people used to believe that people had heads of dogs, and it, bizarrely enough, everybody thought somebody else. I mean, the Portuguese thought the Russians had dog heads, and the Russians thought the Portuguese had dog heads. And of course, there was no internet for them to look at people and say, well, have they got dog heads or not? I mean, what you've got in the modern world is an overload of information, which people then try and simplify. Oh well, it's just these, you know, the nice Israelis who live in nice houses like us and go shopping with credit cards, they're being attacked by
Martin,
barbarians,
etc. The $64,000 question has got to be, where do you go to get some reliable news? Where do you go to get some?
I look at the mainstream stuff, you know, the BBC, The Guardian, The Telegraph, whatever. But I also go to a very good website called Global Research. .ca. It's a Canadian website run by a guy called Chosadovsky, who's an emeritus professor of economics at Ontario University. Lots of very, very interesting stuff on there. I also go to whatreallyhappened.com, which is just have 60 or 70.
Mike Rivero's site is a bit wild, all sorts of
things. So the point about that is you've got to have a load of time to sift through it, because there's loads and loads of stuff on there, some more crazy than others. And I also go to antiwar.com, which is run by right-wing libertarian American Justin Raimondo, whose politics are very different from mine, but I often find interesting things there. And I think the point is that what the internet gives us is the capacity to compare sources. By all means, watch the BBC, but make sure you watch Russia Today and Al Jazeera as well.
Okay, also on the subject of the Middle East, Palestine protesters have occupied land outside Bristol's BBC studios. Free Palestine protesters took their campaign outside to the BBC studios in Clifton. The group vows to remain outside for as long as it takes to persuade the broadcasters to give balanced portrayal of the conflicts in Gaza. Martin.
Well, what goes on is that there's a massive pressure on the mainstream media to give the Israeli spin on events.
Well, there was an enormous demonstration in London last Saturday, which was barely reported. Half a sentence on Channel 4 News.
And
there was a big difference between the police figures saying 6,000 people. Well, I mean, I saw a picture, a long shot, where it looked like there was at least 20,000 people. I mean, just as a guesstimate.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what Mossad calls Hasbara, which is it's basically spin and PR, and Israel knows that it's basically in the wrong on most of these issues, but what they want is for the mainstream media to just say it's six of one and half a dozen of the other. So that then it's like, well, you can understand why the Israelis are bombing them, because they're having rockets fired at them and so on. And therefore, if they can just get people to see the two sides as equally to blame, then they've succeeded. Like when they shot up the Merivi Mara boat, the real question was, did anybody on the boat have any weapons and did they shoot first? In actual fact, they didn't, and they didn't shoot first, but they managed to make the whole world ask that question as if it was a real question. And of course, it's not a real question. It was a stupid question from the get-go. And the Israeli government have admitted they pay students and they pay their university fees and what have you if they will sit for several hours a day going to social media sites pushing the government's line. So I'm afraid that, you know, they're very, very busy at trying to bend people's heads.
Celebrating diversity. This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Well, his name's Robert Steele. He used to work for the CIA. And here he is with some advice to you and I and everyone from an insider about what to do about runaway control by the intelligence services. And I will warn you, there may be a little swearing in this, mild swearing. So if you don't like that sort of thing or the kids around, you might want to turn it off. But anyway, you can have a listen to the podcast later and download it from thisweek.org.uk. So let's have a listen now to former CIA officer Robert Steele.
I'm the son of an oil man. I lived overseas all of my life. I was very fortunate in both having several graduate degrees and being a Marine Corps infantry officer, Marine Corps intelligence officer, and then a clandestine intelligence case officer. I've programmed imagery satellites. I've helped steal signals code books. I've done counterintelligence. I'm basically intimately familiar with the way in which the U.S. government does or does not do the craft of intelligence.
What you need to know is I'm a spy saying spying doesn't work. It's costing you $1.2 billion a week to produce the president's daily brief for a guy that can't read. People don't realize this. Apart from the fact that NSA is 1950s mindsets with 1970s technologies, SAIC completely screwed up Trailblazer, Echelon is baloney, 80% of your signals intelligence comes from analysis of patterns. So you don't need to violate privacy. All you need to know is that Schmuckhead is calling Afghanistan once a week. General Shinseki knew exactly what was needed to make Iraq go right, and Paul Wolfowitz lied to Congress and said they'll receive us like liberators and stuff. If I had been General Shinseki, I would have grabbed Wolfowitz by the neck and thrown him down the steps of Capitol Hill. You don't let people lie like that. It's unprofessional to confuse loyalty with integrity, and we have had a failure of generalship in America. Our generals have been too eager to keep their stars and not eager enough to think for themselves and uphold the Constitution. Smedley Butler, the highest decorated Marine, said, "War is a racket. War is a racket. War is a racket, and the only reason it's happening is because the American public is lethargic. Blog that. You are the Paul Revere's and Patrick Henry's of our generation. Bottom-up horizontal connection is key. Sharing at all levels, not top-down control. Public intelligence and influence is about to take off. We are about to bury rule by secrecy. Civil affairs is the focal point. The intelligence guys need to go back in their box. Bloggers, not informants, are key. The FBI is about to try and hire 2,000 informants in a Soviet police-style approach to security. That's idiocy. If you bloggers self-organize and attach yourself like leeches to specific issues, corporations, organizations, challenges, whatever, you will be the intelligence minutemen of this century. The power is in your hands. There aren't enough guns to kill us all, and Halliburton can't build the jails fast enough to keep us down. Bloggers, as Linux is organized, where you grab onto an issue or something, and you are part of a structured citizen journalism blogging thing that lets no evil doing go unnoticed, that rules. So I think we're at a turning point. I think we're at the very beginning of a historic tidal shift in power restoring the Constitution. I don't know how many of you are following this, but the Comptroller General has told Congress the United States of America is insolvent. We're out of Schlitz. We literally have no money to make it to the next decade. Now, there's some very easy solutions. I can eliminate all income taxes tomorrow and have more than enough money to fund the government by using some other guy's bright idea. We tax the Federal Reserve at 0.0006, doubles our money until we decide to put them out of business permanently, because we certainly should not have central banks. We've put together an electoral reform pledge, and it's my view that any member of Congress, any member of the Senate that refuses to sign both the constitutional pledge supporting the Constitution and the electoral reform pledge should be put out of business. And I believe that will be 95% of all of these people. It may be time to literally dump Congress on its ass and start over. The government has gotten stupid to the point that it can't write a statement of work. And so they ask the contractors to write a statement of work, and the contractors write a statement of work saying, you need more of what I haven't been able to sell. And the government says, oh yeah, right, good, put it in the budget. I can crack all 10 of the top-level threats to humanity in less than 25 years for less than one-third of what the world is spending on the military. Blog that. And I will tell you the price of buying back the United States government. It's $500 million a year. In the early 90s, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans got together. Their plan is now on the street. It's been exposed by a Columbia professor. They concluded that they could buy the United States government from school board to state house to White House for $300 million a year, and by golly, they did. And every single member of Congress is impeachable for having abdicated their Article I responsibilities under the Constitution and serving as foot soldiers for the president and his mendacious vice president. If you confiscate all the wealth in the world, which I do not advocate, all you have is a $5 bill for every one of the 5 billion poor on the planet. For what we have spent on the Iraq war, I could have given a free cell phone to every one of the 5 billion poor on the planet. I could have taken the 10% residual capabilities on DOD satellites, abandoned communication satellites, and I could have provided free T1 to the Southern Hemisphere. Blog that. That's the kind of stuff we have to do.
Well, let's end it there. I mean, just go on a bit, Martin. But, I mean, he's coming up with some sort of basic solutions and saying, well, actually, some of the fundamental decisions that are being made in our society, particularly to do with diverting public resources and tax money towards defence spending, are just ridiculous and very, very simple to change.
Well, I think the simple to change bit is where I would possibly disagree with him. I think the analysis is absolutely correct. There is a huge amount of waste and malfeasance going on. But if it was that easy to change, we'd have changed it. I'm afraid the people at the top who make money out of all of this and who are the powerful ones are not that easy to change.
Maybe the point is it's simple to actually think of a way to change it, but not actually simple to get that change in place.
Well, that's right, because it isn't just a question of thinking of something. It's actually
vested interests are so powerful, then it's surely we're not living in a democracy. I mean, we're talking about the US there.
We're not living... wake up and spell the coffee. We're not living in a democracy. We never have. The struggle for a more democratic society goes on in every generation, and we either go forward or we go backwards, but it's never going to end. We're never going to have a completely free society, and we certainly haven't got one today. What's really clear is we've now got a criminalised elite that are absolutely happy to break their own supposed laws to achieve their goals, and that is not a state of law. That is actually a state which lacks law, and that has got to be the major goal that we've got to fight for. It's what two world wars were supposedly about. We're going to have a rule of law here, and at the moment the Western oligarchy is our scofflaws.
Right, that former guy, CIA guy Robert D. Steele, was talking about the US being insolvent. I mean, you know, that this is doesn't really just depend on the will of the banks as to whether they call loans in, as to whether something is solvent or whether it isn't. Because we are in the similar sort of situation in Britain. We've got 1.3 trillion national debt going up and up all the time. That's never going to be paid off. So surely we're insolvent too.
Well, yes, we are. But the point is that people are still willing to lend us money for now. And the US people are willing to lend the US money because they need to have dollars in order to buy oil. And the whole petrodollar system is based on that. So because people need to have dollars to buy oil, they have to get dollars from their exports in order to get the dollars to buy the oil. And then they've got to do something with them, which means that they buy US treasury. You know, the people who are like the Chinese have to do something with the money they're earning. They buy US treasury.
So this is why the US is more insolvent than any other country on earth.
Because they're allowed to be more insolvent because they're a military superpower and the dollar is the world's reserve currency. But of course, the BRICS are now setting up their own bank. As they said in Brazil, just before the shooting down or the loss of the airliner the other week, and the tectonic plates are shifting. Ultimately, if the US wanted to keep the petrodollar system, they've got to win the wars they fight. And in actual fact, they haven't won one. They've just thrown a lot of money down the drain, which has actually made a lot of people rich. Halliburton, etc., Caleb Brown and Root. But the fact is, unless you win the wars, ultimately the petrodollar system is
history. Hang on, Martin, because they are winning the wars. At least the Western oil companies are now controlling oil in Libya, etc., aren't they?
Yeah, but the real problem...
And Iraq. These concessions have gone to the companies from the West.
Ultimately, the petrodollar system is incredibly fragile, not least because the Chinese Communist Party are holding the US national debt. And if it comes to a showdown, they will crash the US economy. They'll crash their own economy as they go. But that's what world wars look like. In 1914, when after the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in July, or June, I think it was, most people didn't think there was going to be a war until the end of August. But as soon as the war became inevitable, the stock markets crashed. That's how it'll happen this time, possibly before the end of the year. As World War III breaks out, the stock markets will crash. But there's a lot more money and a lot more guns around now than in 1914.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
On to our item on Hitlernomics now. And this is an extract from a documentary called The Hidden Secrets of Money by Mike Maloney. This is from part five, and it looks back at the 1930s.
A few years ago, I was interviewing Congressman Ron Paul. And he said, I think that there's going to be a financial collapse before they come around to thinking seriously about monetary policy. But the real thing we have to worry about is not the loss of our wealth. It's the rise of a dictator. It's the loss of our freedom. And what's interesting is the rise of Hitler, there were two times where he played on the public sphere. He could never have come to power had there not been a hyperinflation back in 1923. Just 1 week before the end of that hyperinflation, that's when Hitler made his first big public appearance. Playing to the public fear, Hitler and his stormtroopers took over a beer hall called the Bürgerbrau Keller that seats around 3,000 people. And he took the stage by gunpoint, and to this literally captive audience, he gave the speech that would change the world. Because of the hyperinflation, the audience had been recently impoverished. Their wealth had been stolen by the government running the printing presses. And so they're all scared. He offers them a scapegoat and tells them he's got the way out. He became very popular after that, and the very next day, the people that were listening to him followed him in an attempt to overthrow the government. He was arrested, tried, and convicted of high treason and served time. While he was in jail, he was provided with a private secretary, Rudolf Hess, and he actually wrote about half of Mein Kampf while he was serving time. But once the economy started to recover, Hitler lost that leverage, that power. He could no longer play on the fear of the public once the economic situation had changed. By the middle of the roaring 20s, he had become a joke. The Nazi Party had gone to less than 2% of the vote. Then along came the Great Depression, and Hitler seized this opportunity again. He was the first politician to actually campaign by aircraft, hitting multiple cities in a single day. And the Nazi Party went from 2% of the vote to the second largest party in Germany. So playing on the public sphere, Hitler was able to take away the rights of Germans. He was able to, all these guaranteed rights in the Weimar Constitution, private property rights, the right to assemble, public assembly, the right to privacy in the mail, the telephone system. He just took away all of their rights and seized power.
Well, they mentioned hyperinflation there. If the petrodollar system collapses, all of the dollars that are held outside the US will flood back into the US, which will cause hyperinflation in the US. Can you see Hitler coming to power in the US or somebody like him? I can.
Okay, Martin, time to sign off now. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Bristol's Mayor George Ferguson. Also, this programme can be found online at thisweek.org.uk, and you'll see our archives there too. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good weekend, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a significant case review is to be held into the death of three-year-old Mikhail Kula, whose mother has admitted his killing. The independent reports, designed to help agencies learn lessons about protecting children from serious abuse. Our reporter James Matthews says Edinburgh High Court was told about internet searches which indicated Rosdeep Adekoya's dislike of her son.
Anger issues signs, she wrote. I always feel angry with my son. I don't love one of my children. Why am I so aggressive with my children? And then, on the day of that fatal assault, the words, get rid of bruises, dash, wiki, how.
The Foreign Office says it's supporting the family of a British man who was killed in yesterday's plane crash in North Africa. 116 people were on the Air Algérie flight when it came down in Mali. Israel Security